BBC Sounds.
Davy Scott here, popping into your classic Scottish albums feed with another bonus episode from BBC Radio Scotland. Our latest episode got under the skin of Seduced and Abandoned by Hue and Cry. I spoke at length with the Cain brothers, Pat and Greg. Greg was with me in our Glasgow studio and Pat was speaking to us remotely from London. I really hope you enjoy what they had to share about the making of the album. First and foremost, I'm so happy we're doing this programme, Seduced and Abandoned. I think a really beautiful record. It really hangs together. It's, what is it? How many years old? You don't need to answer that. But
87, so what's that? 34 years old?
30, no.
Yeah, so sorry to depress you, but it's, I mean, the beautiful thing about it is that, you know, it sounds fresh as the morning milk. It sounds relevant. It sounds you. One of the things for me, just having come to that record at around about the same time making music as you guys, the first thing that I heard by you was a single, I think, was it the year before that, Here Comes Everybody. So we're not talking about that record, but there's a real link sonically between that and what happened. You know, there's a journey there. So just describe how you got from there to Seduced and Abandoned.
Go on, brother, have a go.
Okay. Well, it was on Stampede Records, which was run by a guy who ran the Sub Club, which is a famous club in Glasgow. So it had to be a dancey track because he wouldn't have taken on anything else. So the track that was on that first indie single was called Here Comes Everybody, and it sounded like a kind of punk version of Lionel Richie. I think that's probably the way you would describe it. But of course, the lyric was itself inspired by a combination of James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake, because Here Comes Everybody is the motif that runs through Joyce's most complex novel, and Doc Martin Shaw's Thatcherite boot politics. So some things never change, eh? And then on the B-side of that, which I think was what actually clinched the deal with Circa Records, which led to Seduced and Abandoned in the first place, was two tracks. And one track was called From First to Last, which was a kind of a very, very spectral piano vocal ballad talking about, I think it was one of her relatives. Was it our Aunt May Gregory who had just died?
Yes,
I think it was about her.
My dad's brother. My dad's sister.
Dad's sister. So there was a contrast that the A&R men from London completely loved. And the third track on it was a song called The Successes of Monetarism, which was 3 minutes of silence. So it was all there, basically. If you wanted to sign a spunky, spiky, funky band from Scotland and you were in the market for that, then there we were.
And who were the people around you that were kind of helping facilitate that and help move it? I think I knew some of them, but from your perspective, what was the group around you that helped facilitate your move to Circa?
Cool, Greg.
The people that helped us move to Circa, I mean, we had obviously the Graham Wilson who put out that single, who ran the Sub Club. Then there was a guy that we both know called Bobby Henry, who's not with us anymore, unfortunately. And Bobby came from the same town as we did, a place east of Glasgow called Coatbridge. And when Bobby came home, back up from London, basically to get out of the London scene for a while, he turned up in our local pub, and I was 16, 17, and he was just looking for a music scene, and he found lots of art school students doing music, lots of teachers doing music, lots of students like me doing music, and he was really instrumental in the scene and giving us the encouragement, and we saw the opportunity in him to kind of use his skill and his experience to advance our ambitions. So Bobby was a trusted shoulder to lean on, and he was very selfless in his time and in his advice. So Bobby Henry was very instrumental in it.
It's great to hear, and I suppose one of the things that I think about there, and people that maybe know a bit of the history of that would understand that mix of kind of groove and melody, which is something that's right through all of your work from there to to today, and we'll come back to that maybe. But also thinking about the, and we'll not spend all day talking about the sort of business around this, but I'm quite interested in the in that label, the label that you went to Circa, in terms of some of the other stuff that was there, quite a few Scottish accent associates, Paul Haig there as well, King L I think as well. But
Gary
other
Clark
stuff,
was there for a while.
Yeah, and Nenny Cherry, Massive Attack and all that. What, but there was some, there's something that felt kind of quite special about that label. So what was it got you with them, and were you aware of that sort of that sense of quality about that, that
I think the two guys that started Circa Records were Ashley Newton and Ray Cooper, and they worked for Island Records. What was the guy, Davey? Island Records head. What was his name again?
Blackwell, Chris Blackwell.
Chris Blackwell. So they were Chris Blackwell's sort of prodigies. So they worked with Bob Marley, U2, Frankie Goes to Hollywood, and they had basically seen the mechanics of it all and how it works. And they wanted, with Chris Blackwell's blessing actually, to leave and start their own thing. So, I mean, it was started on business loans and remortgaging houses and credit card extensions. And we were the second band that they signed. So, I mean, they're obviously risk takers. I mean, you wouldn't look at Pat and I, and as Pat has just described, that Here Comes Everybody single, you had the two funky, weird, we liked weird funk. We didn't like, you know, the standards of funk that everybody else liked. The mouthy, opinionated, political.
I mean, defunct was our big band.
So, I mean, they chose us. So they were risk takers, and so were we, because we liked them, because they understood us. Our manager at the time was a wee bit worried because he didn't think they'd any money. And he was saying, if you want to realise your ambitions, which was going to New York and being an international band and realising their funk and soul aspirations, you're going to need a lot more money than these guys have got. So, but we trusted them, and we just went there and said, look, I'm sure something will work out. Pat and I were young kids, so we were used to being impoverished students anyway, so we weren't looking to getting rich quick. So that's why, those were the people that were around Circa. And the thing was, Richard Branson and Virgin at that time were doing something very interesting, which was called AVL, which is called Associated Virgin Labels. So what they were doing is they weren't investing in these small labels, but they were giving them their infrastructure for distribution and advertising. So it was a kind of a, we'll help you out and we'll watch how it goes, and if something interesting appears, then we'll either try and steal it or blah blah blah. But Branson and the Virgin, we were part of the AVL group, so that was a really important part of these small tiny labels. And Circa was born in there's a street called South Moulton Street, which runs parallel to New Bond Street in London, and did a tiny wee office half the size of this studio, Davey.
Just to correct you, Greg, I was walking by it the other day. It's actually Wardour Street.
No, it's South Moulton Street.
Well, I thought it was in Wardour Street.
No, no.
I was standing in Wardour Street.
Well, they did have an office in Wardour Street.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That was after you had a hit. This is before you had a hit.
Is this when they were moving up?
Yeah, I don't think you wanted to. I'm not going in there. It's a bit small.
On. Also,
this is like the good old days, boys.
No, at all.
Do you not remember South Moulton Street?
I remember buying absurdly expensive. Actually, hold on. I didn't
terrible
buy them. I
would,
they were
South
bought
Moulton.
For me, yeah. And they were bought for us on what actually turned out in retrospect to be what had funded the early years of Circa Records, which was Ray Cooper's Black American Express card and Ashley's Black American Express card. So yeah, it was but they also did a thing for Ireland called Fourth and Broadway. That was Ashley Newton's thing, wasn't it? And that was hip. I mean, that was just, at the time, it was just cool American urban funk, and we thought, okay, these people will be good for us.
We'll settle the question about South Moulton Street versus Wardour Street another time.
I'm right by the way.
But don't think you are. Anyway, all right.
So but back to Suggesting Abandon. How many of the songs did you have going up to that? Did you go there with almost a full album's worth of stuff, or was it, did you then have to work on songs?
We had been gigging the songs, brother, eh? We'd been gigging the songs with with previous bands. So we'd gigged us, I can't remember exactly how many songs we had.
We went to Billy Sloan, or we sent a demo of a song called Love is a Master, which eventually ended up, once it's just an abandon, to the Billy Sloan show, which was on Radio Clyde at that time. And it was it was a kind of clunky song, but the song was there, and it manifested itself on the record. And that was a bump with a band called Unity Express. I don't think we weren't even Hue and Cry then. We were Unity Express, inspired by Trans Global Unity Express, which I think was a Paul Weller, a Style Council record, I think. This is how we met Alan McNeil, our manager, who was running Berkeley Street Recording Studios with Stevie Shane at the time. And we came in to do some demos, some of which ended up on the record from doing paper rounds and milk rounds and all that kind of stuff. And he just heard it and said, right, I can take you places with what the kind of music that you're making. That's a blank in my head, Gregory, us writing those songs, other than Labour of Love, which we wrote in what London Street? Certainly in Chapel's music. Well, which street was that in? I can't remember.
That's just off Oxford Street.
Just off Oxford Street. So that's the one song that I remember, that the actual production of it.
I remember writing the keyboard riff for Just One Word at Mum's house.
There you go.
And the piano at Mum's house.
Which is a great riff.
So we wrote in Coatbridge and in London, because Pat had gone to London by then. So,
yeah, I was trying to get into journalism kind of, and I failed.
I was kind of living on it. Do you remember the Knight Rider train with the orange seats?
Yeah.
That was my second home, and I would go down there to work with Pat. So, yeah, half of the record was written in London, half was written up at Mum's.
And we'll maybe come back to some of the process, although I hear what you say, Pat, maybe don't remember all of it. We'll come back to that in a bit. I'm interested to think about the way you recorded it. I mean, right at the start, Greg, you were talking about this ambition to go to New York, and you were able to do that with this record. So you recorded between Savat in Glasgow, and we'll maybe talk about that studio as well, and Sigma in New York, I think it was. That to me sounds like an extraordinary experience for young guys.
Fantastic.
Put us on your shoulder and talk us through the experience of it.
We needed someone, but Pat talked about 4th and Broadway, which is a junction in New York, in Manhattan, and it's also a record label that Ashton and Simpson were on, stuff like that. So the guy that had run that, Ashley Newton, is now a co-owner of Sucker Records, who'd signed Hue and Cry. So there was a route to New York. He could get us there. He put us in touch with a guy who mixed Ain't Nothing Going On But The Rent, the kind of famous sort of 80s, and that was a guy called Harvey J. Goldberg. So he was an engineer that was working out in New York, quite successful engineer. He was a tape op on Inner Visions. You got to tell me, he tells you these stories about when Stevie Wonder wouldn't stop playing new songs. Harvey was told to hide the piano from him. And he told me that. He said, Stevie, only 3 weeks to make the record. And every day, Stevie would come in and go, I've got this new song. And the producer said, Harvey, get rid of that piano. So Stevie would come and go, where's the piano? Stevie, we've got enough songs. So Harvey's got loads of, and Hanging with the Stones, he was an engineer in, wasn't XL Main Street, what was the other one? Later one, the one that's got Respectable on it.
Later on he became the sound engineer for David Letterman and now Stephen Colbert. So he's
well, I'm just talking about back then. So back then, that was the connection. So he'd done mixes for 4th and Broadway. Ashley Newton from Sucker Records flew him over, and we were playing the Sheffield Lead Mill, and he came to see us, and he came backstage and introduced himself, and Pat and I got on quite well with him. He was a wee bit older than us, maybe not that much. Well, 10 years older, maybe, brother.
Yeah.
But at that time, we were in our early 20s, so he was still kind of funky New Yorker in his early 30s. He saw something. He took the risk of coming to Glasgow. So he looked at studios all around Scotland, and he came to Savat Studios in the west end of Glasgow, and he loved it. And he said, we can do the backing tracks here. So we only had enough money to do two songs, which was Labour of Love and Strength to Strength. So we recorded them. They went back to New York. We released Labour of Love. All that started. I remember at the big panoramic glass screen in Savat, we posted up the Music Week chart position. So it started at, you know, for 76 or 78 or something on the left-hand side, and then progressed. And I remember when it got to the middle of the window, it was like, aha, it started to move. So that was us when we started Records Just and Abandoned. So Yes, it wasn't. We weren't making an album. We were making two singles, to be honest, which was Labour Love and Strength of Strength. But when Labour Love started to, we were made Seduced and Abandoned as Labour Love was moving up the charts.
But you know the thing you've reminded me of, Gregory, was having Harvey and another guy. Did Harvey come over? Did Jimmy Beyond the Lilo, his partner, was he over as well? Yeah, but I'm remembering the excitement of a bunch of Scottish musicians, and we all were, loving our funk, loving our soul, loving our jazz. But then having this guy with this pedigree standing in a Glasgow rehearsal room, listening to arrangements, making suggestions.
Oh, yeah, that's
right. It felt incredibly... I mean, all that kind of stuff about Glasgow... All that stuff about Glasgow being this kind of fragment of New York, you know, was just completely true for us. We made it happen, you know, by virtue of the label that we signed to and the people that we reached out to, you know. And I think the musicians around us... Couldn't help but respond and give of their best. I mean, I think they all thought that they'd somehow been transported through the matter transporter in Star Trek to some completely different universe. You know?
I think that to me is that's a big lesson, isn't it? Because so many there are young bands, young musicians, maybe getting a chance like that to work with an outside ear that's going to maybe knock spots off you a wee bit, and it's hard to hear it. But in those moments where you say, right, I'm going to take a leap of faith. And maybe go with this and see what happens. Beautiful things can happen. So I'm imagining that was a massively positive impact on you, and you were ready to take it.
Yeah, I mean, from a personal point of view, I'd nowhere near matured as a musician, as a player. You know, I was nowhere near where I eventually got to. But he didn't look down his nose at us. We had a really tight-knit band. We had a bass player, a drummer, a guitarist and a backing vocalist, and we'd done loads of gigs, and we'd roughed it in vans, we'd roughed it in overnight trains. And when Harvey Goldberg and Jimmy Beyond DeLillo, the two American producers, saw the band and worked with the band rehearsals, they didn't say we need another drummer. They didn't say we need another bass player.
True.
So
it's
we
true.
Didn't suffer that. Mm-hmm. The other bands in our contemporaries had suffered that, oh man, we can't use our bass player and drummer. And, you know, it's a terrible feeling. I've been in that situation. I have actually made that decision when I've been producing bands. It's a horrible thing to do. But, you know, that band that helped us from the mid-80s, they're the band that played Labour Love. They're the band that played Strength to Strength. They're the band that played Seduced and Abandoned.
Yeah, as well. It's great to hear. Let's actually talk about some of the songs. Maybe come back to that impact and the experience of being in New York. But you've led beautifully on, particularly Strength to Strength, which, you know, coming back, I have to say, it's a while since I listened to Seduced and Abandoned the last couple of days, and you put on Strength to Strength, and it's a real killer opening track. And also, I suppose, in the manner of the 1980s, and I mean this in the really... the best sense of that concept, it's like a manifesto, both in terms of what you say in the lyric, but also for me, a kind of manifesto in what your music is, that mix of that melodic thing with the groove and the sort of harmonic complexity of it.
Yeah.
Now, you're going to tell me that I've got that all wrong.
You're totally right. It's like, I mean, I thought that was the best track on the album because I thought it was the most ambitious. And it was like, what does it remind me of? It's like Jackson's Can You Feel It? You know, it's like Marvin Gaye's What's Going On? You know, it's also aspirational. The lyric is aspirational. And it's a boy walking in the light, girl with a big desire. And the whole thing about the way that those late 80s Scottish bands operated in relationship to the music business, but also in relationship to Scotland, is that they felt as if they were... So many people came up to me and said, I'm incredibly proud of you. And it's like, well, what have I actually done that you might be proud of me? But it was because of this unwarranted self-confidence. And Strength to Strength is a classic expression of that. Musically as well. I mean, I think it's just... I was always into ornate, never knowingly under complexified a piece of music should be for me, and often we've fallen foul of that. But so many times on Seduced and Abandoned, it was like this kind of combination of sheer reach. Let's make this record sound as good as anything we've ever heard, as best as we can, and the desire to communicate, write a hit record. I mean, that was definitely our ambition. It was definitely Greg's ambition. I was, you know, well tobered by him when it came to kind of, you know, picking out riffs and repeating.
I haven't tobered you for a while, brother. Well, should maybe just tober you a bit more.
Maybe you should tober a bit more. Maybe I'm self-tobering now. It's auto-tobering. But he would, Gregory had the pop ambition and the chops, and I was a combination between Malcolm McLaren and Frank Sinatra. I just wanted the songs to get up to all kinds of mischief. So that's, you're right to identify strength. The strength is definitive of what we're trying to do.
And it's widescreen as well, isn't it? I mean, just in terms of the arrangement and the way it sounds, it's got that kind of width and depth about it. For you, as what age were you when you were doing that? Early 20s?
20,
okay. So I'm trying to imagine the experience of hearing that, forming. You're obviously forming it, but at the same time, there is that thing when you're making music where you're also kind of standing outside and you think, God, this sounds amazing. What was that experience like? Just put us in the room with you when that sound was beginning to come forth.
Well, as I said, it was a 5-piece band in the room making the kind of vibe. We did play it, too technical, but we did play it to clicks. Tony, our drummer, wanted to play it to clicks. It made him feel more relaxed. So we said, right, okay, but it wasn't pushed upon him. So as you know, Davey, if you get 5 guys in the right mood at the right time, at the same time, in the right place, it's a lightning in a bottle thing. So I guess that was the beginning of it. You have to build on song foundations. So I remember those backing tracks in Savat and then finishing them and asking Harvey Goldberg, the producer, have we got enough? And he said, yeah. He knew he'd got what he needed. I can't remember if he spliced anything together. I'm not sure. I can't remember that part. But it was recorded not even in 24 track, it was 16 track it was recorded on.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, we can get into, I don't want to get too technical on it because people have turned off.
No, we can a wee bit because the thing is, we might not use that. I mean, listen, we'll not spend ages on it, but that's interesting because I think people that are in a deep dive on the music are thinking, gosh, because it does sound complex and it does sound multi-layered and you're able to do that in that and limited.
Well, if you want to talk about it, you let me know when you want to talk about it.
the scene I remember in terms of how does this sound come to be and how does it piece itself together was when we took the tracks over to New York. Do you want to go there, Davey, or is
yeah,
that
yeah.
too early?
Yeah, no, it's good. It's good. And I do want to hear about the tracking process and technical stuff as well. So let's have it.
This is sort of not technical. This is totally romantic. So basically we've taken the tracks over to New York and we're sitting on a 30-odd floor of the Carnegie Muse in Midtown Manhattan, and that's where Jimmy Biondolillo, who was a kind of bag carrier for Frank Sinatra, was helping us to arrange the strings and to arrange the horns. And
was he not Don Costa's sidekick?
Don Costa, who was Frank Sinatra's arranger, beg your pardon. And we're singing, we are literally singing out the melodies. This should go da 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 da, Labour of Love riffs. And I remember that in his tiny flat, which was basically with a fold-down bed, a kitchen, two inches away, and a gigantic TV the other side of that. Jimmy hanging on in Manhattan, working, but not living in luxury, but working, having a fantastic career. And looking around and seeing the New Yorker building across the way, the kind of the magazine, the New Yorker with that straight across the top of the, and thinking, this can't be real, can it? I'm possibly dreaming here, or I'm on a trip of some description, And then the next stage of that would be to turn up on the day when the horns start to play or the strings start to lay it down. And then, you suddenly, what you're sort of realizing is you are part of a kind of moment of excellence, a moment of skill and virtuosity and seriousness about music, which will spoil you for the rest of your life. You get at that age, that high standard, that early, and you're not just a bit player in it, you're the central player in it, because you're writing the songs and you're performing and guiding the music. So it ruins you for life. I mean, you think if that's what you're going to get at 22, imagine what it's going to be like when I'm 32 or 42 or 52. So the standards that we've tried to follow all the way through in the subsequent decades totally set there, and it, we pulled it off. I mean, there's no doubt about it. We weren't intimidated. We weren't freaked out. Gregory was, you know, amazing for his age, the confidence that he had to go in and deal with these musicians and these arrangers. So the, that's my experience, is just, you know, flying through the sky on the top of a skyscraper, writing riffs from a record that I've always wanted to hear because we've made it together.
Yeah, that's beautiful. You started talking about Labour of Love there. I saw you guys open at the, not say awards, the Nordoff Robins, maybe, I don't know, 8 years ago or something mm-hmm. like that. And you opened with Labour of Love, as I recall, and it was actually like getting hit by a train. I mean, it was just one of those things. People were kind of like, wow, that seems so, like, boom.
As a guitarist, I'll tell you, Davey, where the riff comes from. You'll understand it. So when you're checking the tuning for your guitar, you would play an open A minor 7th and you just slide it up 2 frets and you let the A drone. And I watched our guitarist one day tune up his guitar. I was like, what are you doing there? I said, I use this A minor 7 drone thing to make sure my guitar's in tune. Do it again. Dun, 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 ba, ba. That's it. That's where it comes from.
So it comes from that simple idea, and then it's built. But there is all that interlocking stuff, and I think, yeah. Pat, you were kind of indicating that in the last response. So all of that and the complexity of that, so that is that's happening in the rehearse room and then in Sava as a backing track?
It's happening in the writing room. I mean, not to concentrate on Labour Love for too long, but we wrote that in Chapel Publishing's headquarters in London, and they had little writing rooms, that corridor full of writing rooms. The Proclaimers had a lot of Sunshine and Leith in that corridor as well, and they had a little, I think they're called a 76 Roland something 76, a wee beatbox, and you could put bossa nova, cha-cha, swing, these wee boxes. So there was a Latin one, and it went beep beep boo doo beep beep boo doo boo beep beep doo doo beep beep boo doo, and we put it on, stuck it at 123 BPM because that seemed to be 123 BPM, and that's dum 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 da dum dum da dum dum beep beep doo doo ding ding, and that's where it came from.
I love it. That's in.
Yeah, that's where it came.
Find the beatbox and play it and see if we can.
Well, I've got it on my phone. I've got a virtual version of the beatbox on my phone. If you give me 5 minutes, I'll get it out.
Let's see if we can do that. That would be amazing. And of course, that is the one that sort of went over. You've already talked about that. What kind of watching it on the glass mm-hmm. and some mm-hmm. What is it that you think made that song go over in terms of audience and become the hit it was? What was it about it that connected?
I think it was the energy, and it was the summer of 87. And there was an energy. I remember recording, just when we were talking about going over to New York, and I remember spooling on the tape in New York, and, you know, we hadn't, the thing about moving to another studio when you make an album is that experience when you spool it on and you listen to come out a different set of speakers in a different room. And all I'd ever heard of this was from Savar. And when we spooled it on, and there was Don Cuminale, the engineer, mm-hmm. and Fernando mm-hmm. Kral, who'd been working with Talking Heads the day before. You're like, okay then. So you spool it on, or they spool it on, and Harvey says it throws up some of the faders, and the drums sounded fantastic. And I was like, oh, wow. I was so proud. And I remember the engineer going, where did you record those drums? And I explained the room to him, showed him some photographs of it, and he said, wow. And I said, but it depends where you place them, because there's a little balcony that if you place the drums under that, you can get rid of some of the kind of massiveness of it. And so we got it. But I was so proud of Savar, and I was so proud of Glasgow, and I was so proud of the musicians. We couldn't afford to take them all over. You know, it was still, budgets were tight. I think they really wanted to go over to New York and make a record, but they brought their A game to Savar, and then we brought their A game to New York, and their A game was more than good enough for Sigma Sound in New York on Hollywood. I'm sorry, on Sigma Sound in New York on Broadway.
Don't get the street wrong, Greg.
Don't get the city wrong.
You get pulled up.
And just to say, Sigma Sound is just above the Ed Sullivan Theatre, where Elvis and the Beatles
and the Fabs
gyrated the hips. So the vibes were unbelievable as you walked up and down to get to Sigma Sound Studios. But I mean, see the sense of the St. Gregory's hinted at it there, but see the sense of sheer pride from two young men who have been drenched in American music, jazz music from their fathers, soul music and funk music from their own explorations as young men, to sort of turn up and actually cut it in New York amongst all these musicians. You know, it was a real chest buster. You know, loved it. It was a brilliant feeling. And we thought anything was possible. It was really a moment in your life when you think anything is possible.
There's another song, part that I always think feels so New York, which is "Goodbye to Me." And I think, you know, I hear Steely Dan, Anita Baker. You know, I don't know, tons of things in there that feel really New York to me.
But that's Tam Bob in New York, though. I mean, I'm licking up the chicken, I'm chewing on the gravy. That's him on his flight over. And he's trying to communicate, the beggar's got no money, the beggar is not me. Can you, cream cheese and bagel, please? Can you understand me? I know I'm coming from Scotland, but is it possible you could understand me? So the whole lyric of that is an intimidated wee guy from Scotland coming over to New York for the first time. And to write about that was just funny, you know, because the backing track that Gregory pulled together and was so slick, you know, and sort of techno soul. So there's a lot of humour in these songs. I think they're often regarded as a wee bit po-faced, but there's a lot of irony and humour and self-deprecation.
Yeah, and playfulness.
How could there not be?
But playfulness as well, I think, Pat, and I think in the music and the lyric as well. And for me, just, you know, coming back to that song, there is that feeling of optimism and humour, but there's a deflation about it as well. And says, God, this is the reality of my experience here. There's an intimidation. It's a lovely thing, and it's got that full of hooks as well. And one of the things I was wanting to ask you about in terms of your writing process is how focused are you, I've talked then and right up to the present day, on that thing about developing hooks in the music and developing focus and little bits of it. Is that something, is it instinctive for you, or are you crafting as well?
Go, Greg.
Am I crafting? I'm listening. There's a lot of, it takes us quite a while to get to what the song is, and I seem to be able to make mental notes of all the nearly bits, and all the nearly bits, when you bring them all together, make some really good bits, but they're not the focus bits. So all the kind of incidentals that support what we do rhythmically, melodically and harmonically are usually part of the journey to get there. And I've always been able to remember them and make a mental note of them. So, it's a songwriter, David. It's just the journey from idea to I can play it to someone. Pat and I would always try and say we're not leaving the room unless we could go down the pub and play a verse and a chorus. And it's always, we can't walk away from something that's lying in bits. We've never had any songs lying in bits. It's always been a thing for us. Yeah. Can't walk away from something like that. You've got to keep going.
One of the things I wanted to talk to you both about, and Pat, you started to talk a wee bit about how you did that in terms of singing horn lines and string lines and all that. It's a lovely string, and I think it's baritone sax arrangement on "I Refuse," which really kind of, I mean, it's a great song, but the arrangement does just kind of lift it. How much of that were you working cheek by jowl with arrangers, or were you coming in with all of those parts? Is that something that you conceived of with the song?
No, we weren't coming in with the parts. As Pat explained, the arranger was the guy, Jimmy Biondolillo, who's Don Costa's understudy or runner, or I can't remember exactly. But Jimmy was such a kind, classic Midwestern Italian-American, and he knew how to score it. He was aware of what arrangements would work and what wouldn't. So he let us sing to him what we thought it should be, and he kindly pointed us in the direction they think would work. He was such a master of men, Jimmy Biondolillo. He could really, now when I think back about it, he was such a skillful man. So all those string lines and all the are kind of Pat and I and Jimmy allowing us to be what we are, and then making the most of that without upsetting us. I mean, that's really skillful. Pat and I, the two main artists, are singing lines to him, and he's kind of going, yep. And then when he writes the thing and you listen to the strings playing, it's not quite exactly what you sang, but it's so, oh yeah, that's great. You can't deny it's not great. So he was a really skillful man, Jimmy. But it came from the three of us in his apartment singing. We did a thing, and I still do it to this day, in my studio, and Pat and I's studio, I've got one wall that's just a massive projector, and we'll watch movies. Love watching movies. when Jimmy and Pat and I would go and write song lines and the string lines, he'd just randomly just stick on a movie.
Yeah.
And we'd be in the middle of writing something and he'd go, right, enough, and he'd put a movie on. And it's the middle of the afternoon. And you sit down, and before you know it, you're getting sucked into some classic old movie. I think the one was some Hitchcock used to play part, wasn't it? And he used to.
Was it Rear Window and Vertigo?
Yeah, yeah. And then he'd just randomly stop it. Yeah. After about half an hour, and go, right, where were we? And he'd start playing again. We go, we stopped watching the movie now.
35 floors up the Carnegie Muse, and you're watching.
I can't remember part of that was a tactic of his, but I see.
Oh, it totally was.
But what was the purpose then? Just to kind of, I don't know.
Just to kind of totally rearrange the molecules in your head and see what would come out from your imagination. I mean, it's actually.
But he did it mid-arrangement, though.
I know, but that's cool.
There's a story about Brian Wilson in a session with Linda Ronstadt doing backing vocals for a song called Adios, Jimmy Webb song.
Oh yeah.
And she says that he got stuck at a bit. And he started arguing with himself on the mic. Right? You can't do this. Yeah, you're useless. You can't do this. And he says to himself, you're just going to have to go to the piano. So he goes over to the piano and he plays a boogie-woogie song, as she's had it, in a different key, right, for 2-3 minutes, then comes back and says, right, give me a track, and boom. Right, and so maybe it's that thing. I mean, I love that story.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, maybe it's that thing about resetting the molecules. Is that what you said? Molecules,
get
what?
Yeah, rearranging the molecules in the head or the body. You know, because you're just. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's like fantasy upon fantasy. I've got the New York building outside, and I've got Rear Window out there, and I've got my first ever blueberry muffin in my lap. You know, or sesame chicken with bread with seeded broccoli, and I'm thinking. This still isn't real.
Julianne's Deli, yep.
Talk to us a little bit. One thing we've really not spoken about, and it's the thing that's always kind of attached to you guys, is that politics, social politics thing. And it's in full bloom on this record.
And I
Refuse is one that I think something that people would really have understood that language and what it was saying at the time. Talk to us a little bit about that. And again, maybe probably as well your perspective on it now.
Sure. I mean, again, a young man just out of university, full of theories of all kinds, literary, political, philosophical, inspired by punk and post-punk, you know, primarily bands like Gang of Four and Skitty Politti, who were already doing that. So I had a template. I mean, even Martin Fry from ABC was saying, put me in a gold lamy suit, I'm still a punk rocker. You know, so... And also, it was just after 1987 was about 2 years, a year after the miners' strike was conducted and the miners were crushed by the Thatcher regime. So that the air was heady, and even so, just in terms of artistic self-expression, David, you know, what's inside you has to come out in a song. Then it was going to come out, but I mean, it was taken to some absurd extremes on that record. I mean, there was a song called Alligator Man. Which was basically the front page of the Morning Star for about 5 days a week, condensed into verse, chorus, bridge, middle, end, fade, about multinational capitalism and its exploitative depredations on local communities. I mean, honestly, you know, if it was Groucho Marxist, it would have been great. It was actually Karl Marxist all the way down the line. So what can I say? I mean, nowadays... I don't think my politics have moderated any. I think I'm maybe just a wee bit more considerate of the diversity of one's audience, you know. So when we play all these songs from Seduced and Abandoned, I mean, we did a piano vocal gig the other day, Gregory, where we played Alligator Man in a piano vocal version, you know. And it was just this weird experience because Gregory's playing like Melodious Thunk or Thelonious Monk, you know, and I'm shouting about... exploitation, you know, at the top of my voice. So it's fun. I regard that with a great degree of sympathy and tolerance. I don't know if anybody else does, but
yeah, it was distinctive.
But the thing was, you think back, you know, the Sucker Records, they were investing a lot of money in us. Paul Kern had signed us to Warner Chappells, and I can't remember, Pat, we'd no pressure from them.
No, not
to change direction.
Not an ounce.
And I think back now, they must have been talking to their bosses or thinking, going, right, come on, can they not just sing, as my dad used to say, Love, Dove, Moon, June? Can they not just do that?
That's exactly what he used to say.
That was his, you used to play my father, your new record, and he'd go, Can I just do Love Dove Moon June? But we had no pressure from our publisher or our record company to do that. And you think back now, Pat, I mean, we must have really annoyed them by not giving them the kudos saying thank you for allowing us to do that, because they did. And we didn't do it. We went to New York to do it. We could have done it in Cold Bridge in Glasgow. You could have shouted as much as you wanted, but we got to, you know, go to New York to do it.
But I think we were lucky, because we grew up listening to the Specials on the radio and the Clash on the radio, and we grew up in a punk, post-punk time when it was just punk. So I think we were riding out our luck on the last waves, reverberations of the punk and the post-punk moment. And I think after that, it went in a different direction. I mean, you know, raves started to happen and techno started to happen and gigantic raves and warehouses where the police were chasing you for doing repetitive beats. That all started to happen. Mm. And I think we just caught the liberalism and the freedom of that moment. I mean, I Refuse is inspired by, you know, the 60s radical philosopher Herbert Marcuse talked about the Great Refusal. I mean, that's... I was absolutely chancing it, just shoving everything I had in me, which was just feelings and scholarship, into a 3.5 minute pop song. I mean, it should have been arrested, you know.
It's a beautiful thing. We were talking earlier on, and I'm winding back a wee bit now, because you talked really warmly about the musicians that were with you in those days and who helped you shape those sounds. One thing, producer Lizzie Clark sent me an early performance of Love is the Answer from FSD, which I don't know if you remember that performance.
Mm-hmm. I do.
I have to say, Pat, you're wearing a stunning stripy T-shirt.
Yes, I mean, I don't know. Like, I know.
I mean, really good, and the denim jacket, the whole thing is good. But the performance itself and the arrangement of it, I'm not being funny. I thought, God, that is a look.
That was the swing version we did.
Yeah, so that's what I want to ask you about. So was that what it was, and then it went somewhere else, or were you just playing with it?
That's what it was, and then as we spoke to before, our friend Bobby Henry went through all the songs that we had and said, could you not try it this way? We tried it many different ways. One of our great friends, the saxophonist Tommy Smith, always says to me, any song can be played any way. So we've always not really worried about how we play this song. So there was always different versions of the songs kicking around, and there was never really a definitive one. It just depended what kind of mood pattern we were in. So I guess that swing version of Love is a Master, that's the kind of mood we were in. The saxophone player that was playing with us was a guy called Manny Ferry, who was quite a famous swing saxophone player. And we used his... This is an era, our parents' era, and Alex Dalgleish played trumpet. So they were coming from an old swing area, so it was probably swing era, so it was probably they were quite influential. Plus, Pat and I adhere to the, you know, the mantra of it don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing, you know. Yeah. It has to swing. We love swinging, and it's not easy to swing.
Well, I've seldom tried.
I think you'd be quite good at swinging, Steve.
Let's talk. I'm happy to talk about all of the songs on the record. I had probably six on my list that I thought were good to talk about.
Right,
and the last one was Truth for me. Ooh. Obviously, oh, wow. that's a beautiful thing. And Pat, you've been chucking out all sorts of amazing references in terms of your lyrics. I wondered if there was a wee bit of shade of Vince Guaraldi in that piano figure at the start of that. I don't know. There's something about the kind of the way that harmony moves. It's so beautiful, and also the arrangement of it is so lush and so kind of complex.
Do you want to recall the session? It was recorded live.
It was recorded live. The song it actually ties all the way back to the B-side of our first independent single, which got the whole ball started, got the A&R people interested. And it was this piano vocal ballad called Truth. The picture on the album cover was of Oliver North, the famously mendacious military colonel who was running affairs with the Iran-Contras and all the rest of it. And so the song, the lyric was about a politician confessing the constructions and the falsenesses and the lies and the deceptions that constituted his political career. So sung as a heroic Broadway-like ballad. So what the hell do you do with that? But what a day in the studio! What a day! You walk in, and then you walk into the studio at Sigma Sound, and there is New York's violin and string finest, all there.
all he cut arranged. The strings as well. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
So you're standing, and it's like, what do you do now? I've got to sing, and even if it's just a guide vocal, I've got to sing in front of these people.
No, you were in a booth, you know? Dude. You had to sing it.
And you know, they're all making their New York quips, and the concert leaders sort of getting them together, and then we run down the track, and there's a sort of, it goes all the way through. I'm surfing like a crazy thing over this utopia of strings. I'm coursing up and down it, and I'm trying to kind of match the grandeur of it and all the rest of it. And then at the end of it, one of the guys turns around and says, you know, you have like a kind of a Broadway musical theatre thing going on with your voice. It's good. It's characterful, you know? And I'm like, okay, I think that's not quite what I wanted to hear, but it's interesting. I'll run with it. And so we did it. We did it, like, I think, 3 or 4 times, Gregory, did mm-hmm. we do it? Mm-hmm. And it was like, every one of my dreams was fulfilled. And it's interesting, Davey, you know, when you're talking about how old is this record? So it's 30-odd years. 30-odd years before the time that we made the record in 86, 87 was the heyday of Sinatra and was the heyday of his records that he made with Nelson Riddle and Gordon Jenkins, you know. And that's what in the kind of the whole retro refresh of the way people were listening to music in the 80s, that was the stuff that was in my CD pack that I listened to on my Walkman CD. I was listening to In the Wee Small Hours of the Morning or Only the Lonely, you know, or September of My Years, you know. So it couldn't have been more of a dream realised to stand in front of a bunch of cynical New Yorkers and for us to get their respect, both for the music and for a performance. A very special moment.
I, you know, we're talking about you doing the vocal, you're sitting there doing that piano take.
I was in the room with the strings.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't, you know, you've been in so many studios, the big live room, the piano sits there, and you just go with the take. I just wish I'd played it softer, but I didn't, so. And you've got regrets listening back. When are we going to, is there going to be a regret section of this?
Well, I'll tell you what, you've taken it right. You've pivoted us right back to where we always try and kind of, you know, get to the end of these interviews, and it's an important one, and that is, how does it stand up for you? I mean, we're calling it a classic Scottish album, which it assuredly is. Mm-hmm. How does it stand up for you?
I love the record.
I wish I'd played Truth quieter. I wish the drums on Say Goodbye to Me had one more loop. That needs one more loop. But it's got a hole in it. And it's a hole in the groove. And maybe that's what gives it its space. But I thought there could be one more loop.
Oh, come on, say something positive, you, or I'm going to have to say all the positive stuff.
I thought this is the no regret. Is this the regret section?
You don't have to have regrets. I think it's as a body of work, you know, I'm not sure if you listen to your own records, but as a body of work, you certainly approach them because you play them live. Uh-huh. Does it have a resonance for you as artists now?
I think it does. This happens to us all the time. So we had a deaf saxophone player who was deafing for our saxophone player at gigs recently. And he kind of, nice, lovely guy, Gordon, and he came up and he says, look, Greg, I have to thank you for the music. A young guy, they're all younger than us, all conservatoire kids and blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, no problem. He says, if it wasn't for you doing the kind of music that you did, I wouldn't be here. And we get that a lot from young musicians. They're not saying you're a great, you know, they're just saying, if you hadn't done what you did, I wouldn't be here, because I didn't think I could, there was somewhere to go trying to make this kind of music. So I'm very proud of that, because they're just abandoned what it achieved, and if there's a young kid at 9-10 years old listening to that, and listening to the strings, and listening to the grooves, and listening to the horns, listening to Pat crooning, and listening to this thumping Latin piano going, what's that? That's the kind of stuff. And look, all the kids are dancing about and everybody's chasing them down the street. This is amazing. So if that's what the music did, then I'm really proud of it.
I mean, the only thing I would add would be there are tracks on it that you won't play, but there are that I love, tracks like History City and Something Warmer and Just One Word. I mean, Just One Word, is an attempt to be as groovy as anything you've ever heard from your favourite record collection, you know, and you're just thinking, I wonder if we can get there. I wonder if we can approach that. So it's also a very tiring, by God, is it a young man's record. So, you know, we carefully place Labour of Love in the set at the moment just so that we can have maximum energy to play the damn thing.
I noticed that at the weekend, brother. You played it pretty early in the set as well. Check you out.
Well, it was great. I felt not completely shredded by the time it got to the end of the gig, you know.
Skillfully done, my brother. Skillfully done.
Yeah, adroitly done. But this, so it's a very young man's record. It's an ambitious record. I actually love the political ambition of it. We were listening to a lot of, I think another big influence on the record that maybe not be apparent is Elvis Costello, you know, because you're listening to Shipbuilding, you're listening to Pills and Soap, you're listening to Imperial Bedroom, you're listening to all his attempt, you know, to make the ultimate pop song, which is historically relevant and lyrically and musically beautiful and powerful. So I hear all that. I hear the template for the succeeding 30-odd years, and I'm proud to play the songs. I think the songs are ambitious and full of depth, but also totally attractive and attempting to be number one in every territory in the planet. So what more can you want?
Where do you think it fits as a Scottish record, right? You know, do you think of it as a Scottish record? Is there a continuum along which it lies or aligns with?
I do think it's a Scottish record. I think it belongs amongst us all those people that were making music back then. I could name so many bands now, but they didn't really have the Labour of Love. There was a lot of soul and funk around back then, Davey, and you know, Pat and I felt in a comfortable place making that kind of music. And when I used to go clubbing at that age, they were still playing a lot of James Brown, a lot of weird Stevie Wonder stuff, a lot of Sly Stone. That was all around me when I was going out the weekend hanging with my friends. So it fitted with all that. So and the soul and funk scene in Scotland was massive during the 80s. You know,
we came and did a gig, some songs with the Average White Band for I think a Celtic Connections event, and I remember listening to Feel No Fret, which was their big album. We had When Will You Be Mine on it when I was a wee boy, and it's one of these things that you remember listening to a piece of music and all your goosebumps go up and you think, that's a Scottish thing. That's completely brilliant. So I think I think what was interesting about Scotland's use of funk and soul was that it bypassed London. It sort of said, right, okay, we're a wee bit intimidated by London. We're a wee bit of a cringe here. We're just going to go straight to Detroit, or going to go straight to New York, or straight to Los Angeles. So I think Americana and American music has always been a bit of a dignified escape route for a lot of Scottish artists. And that went alongside the funk and the soul went alongside the punk. So I think it's part of that total Caledonia dreaming romance with America, which allows you to be in the world, being part of the world, singing in English, living out your dreams, singing in an American accent. I mean, that's still so there's an element of total fantasy about it from top to bottom. But my father sang like Frank Sinatra and Matt Monro, so, and he did that because he wanted to be flown to the moon at the earliest opportunity. So I'm not any different, and we're not any different. Aspiration is what it's all about.
Thank you so much, both of you, for just your honesty and all of the colour of your stories. It's a beautiful thing. Yeah, I really enjoyed that chat with Pat and Greg, especially their memories of the work they did at Sigma Studios in New York. Really brilliant insights into the making of that lovely album, Seduced and Abandoned. Don't forget to check out the All Singing, All Dancing episode, complete with the top tracks from the album. It's on the Classic Scottish Albums feed now on BBC Sounds. I'm Davey Scott. Thanks for listening.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.